If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show, and we are shifting gears now a little earlier than usual to the world of politics. A lot happened in the past week. After the break, Amanda Vinicky of Chicago Tonight on WTTW in Chicago and Alex Degman of Illinois Public Radio will join us to talk through what happened in the first 2 weeks, I should say the first of 2 weeks, of the veto session for the Illinois General Assembly. But first, in Washington, there is a new Speaker of the House, white smoke from the Republican conclave. It's a man named Mike Johnson. He's represents part of Louisiana. To take us through how we got here and what lies ahead for the House, we are joined, as always, by Linda Kenyon. She covers Washington politics and our home state congressional delegation for Illinois Public Media. Linda, happy Friday. Congratulations on a return to somewhat regular order, maybe, in the Congress.
I thought you were going to say congratulations on the end of this crazy week.
Or month, or the longest, 10 years of your life in the past 3 weeks.
Yes. I have to tell you, The Washington press corps is completely worn out, and so are members of the House. But what happened? Well, they finally chose a Speaker of the House after several choices did not make it. As you know, House Speaker, now former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, was ousted. Then the House Majority Leader, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, flirted with the idea of running for Speaker of the House and decided not to do it. After all, he dropped out. Then there was Jim Jordan of Ohio, and he went through three ballots on the House floor, and with each successive ballot, he lost more votes. He was getting further away from the goal of a simple majority of 217. So the Republican caucus pulled his nomination. Then there was Tom Emmer, who was number three in the Republican Party. You're getting the idea. Emmer was the nominee for a full 4 hours.
I was going to say, was it minutes or hours that we're measuring hours. That by? Yeah, okay.
And then he dropped out, and we had Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, and he became the nominee in a closed-door caucus meeting late into the night, and then the next day, this week, they brought it to the floor, and he passed on the first ballot. And I think one of the reasons is because the Republicans were starting to realize that they couldn't do this forever. They needed a Speaker of the House. And this had become embarrassing quite some time ago. And that Mike Johnson was going to be the guy because they, too, were worn out. But now people are saying things about Mike Johnson that a lot of constituents, for example, didn't know about. For example, his conservative philosophy and the fact that he is an election denier. This has brought election denialism to a new height. And there is a lot of questions about the fact that he still will not say that Joe Biden is president of the United States and that Donald Trump lost the election.
Yeah, you know, I must admit, I had never heard of Mike Johnson until a couple of days ago. I've heard some people refer to him as basically Jim Jordan with a jacket. His colleague Matt Gaetz even told, I think it was on the Steve Bannon podcast, that he was quote unquote MAGA Mike Johnson for the, you know, Trump acolytes who call themselves MAGA or Make America Great Again. You know, what do we know about his plans for the House?
Well, I will tell you, there are some other comments about him. For example, Jamie Raskin, who serves with him on the House Judiciary Committee. By the way, he will no longer be serving on the Judiciary Committee. I'm talking about Mike Johnson because he'll be Speaker of the House. He is Speaker of the House. But Jamie Raskin, who tangled with him quite a bit, he said regarding Mike Johnson, he's a huge MAGA extremist. He just has better manners than Jim Jordan. So that gives you an idea. John Fetterman, senator from Pennsylvania, made a comment I can't even say on the radio about Mike Johnson. And so there are a lot of concerns. But what does he stand for? Well, he says he is a Bible-believing Christian. That's a quote. He is also the architect of a legal strategy to overturn the 2020 election. He filed an amicus brief with the U.S. Supreme Court, and that eventually was thrown out by the Supreme Court. They said it had no merit, and there was no evidence that proved that the 2020 election was stolen. He voted against the election results in Arizona and Pennsylvania after the Supreme Court's ruling. And again, he continues to thwart direct questions about whether he believes Joe Biden is the legitimate president of the United States. Now, one of the reasons that Jim Jordan of Ohio was not able to make it past three ballots is because there are a number of Republicans in the House who are not as extreme as, for example, the House Freedom Caucus, which led the charge to oust now former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. So the situation being the same right now, where we have Mike Johnson, who is an election denier. Jim Jordan was an election denier, and the moderate Republicans found that very uncomfortable for them, especially a group of 20 who hail from purple districts, or quite frankly, completely blue districts, Democratic districts. And if they want to keep their jobs, they have to keep their constituents in mind. And that means they cannot embrace the MAGA Republicanism.
Not just keep their jobs, but for the entire party to keep its majority. You know, you mentioned Speaker Johnson has refused to talk about January 6th. And in fact, there was that moment where his colleagues booed down a reporter who tried to ask him about it. And, you know, a common thought we've heard from Republicans, and I should say we only have about 3 minutes left, but a common thought we have heard from Republicans on our program is that the media is sort of fixated on the past by continuing to talk about January 6th. But I heard John Dickerson, CBS reporter and a member on a Slate podcast, arguing January 6th is really a question about the future, right? Because this is going to come up again in 2024 and 2028 and, you know, the future of our democracy. Do we respect the results of elections? As a longtime observer of Washington politics, what do you make of that and the fact that someone who was so involved in the January 6th certification denialism is now the speaker?
Well, it certainly does show that the way that Congress operates has changed in leaps and bounds over the years I've been covering Congress. And it shows that there is a very big divide between the Republicans and the Democrats. There was always a divide, but now it's more of a chasm. And I think that it reflects a lot of the views of the American people. So if the American people can't have a conversation around the Thanksgiving dinner table about who is the duly elected president of the United States, well, then why expect Congress to be able to have a valid discussion about that issue? Because they reflect the viewpoints, or are elected to reflect the viewpoints, of their constituents. You have three Republicans in your local area, Mary Miller of the 15th, Darren LaHood of the 16th, and Mike Bost of the 12th Congressional District. They all supported Mike Johnson. They were very, very high on Mike Johnson, and in part because of his election denialism. But then you have the Democrats, for example, Nikki Budzinski from the 13th. And she said that she is a Democrat. She said that Mike Johnson is inexperienced and that he has extreme views and that he is destructive to Congress and to the country. So, you know, again, this election divide, this election denialism is more extreme than I have seen in the many years I've been up on Capitol Hill or at the White House. So is the country.
Briefly, in about 30 seconds, maybe, what is all this? We almost had a government shutdown. There was a 45-day pause button, that continuing resolution. We've now burned through 3 weeks of that time with this other thing that has nothing to do with the federal budget. What are you watching for in the next few weeks?
Well, in the next few weeks, they're going to have to pass the remaining annual appropriations bills. There's seven left to go in the House. Anything that passes in the House, one, by the way, passed yesterday, has to go to the Senate. And the Senate is not going to countenance any of these bills right now because they consider them very extreme. One that passed yesterday cuts funding for energy and green energy projects. And then after that, they are going to have to deal with, or simultaneously deal with, funding for Ukraine's war with Russia and Israel's war with Hamas. And Mike Johnson has said, as recently as just a few moments ago, he said that we're going to have to bifurcate that funding. In other words, it will not look like what the president wanted, which was one major bill
package
for national security.
Yeah. Well, Linda Kenyon, we can count on you to keep us up to date on what's been happening in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are in the middle of our Friday politics roundtable, and we're going to shift now from federal politics to state politics and government. The Illinois General Assembly has wrapped up its first week of the fall veto session. At least one piece of legislation the governor vetoed has been left to meet its fate. It's not going to be taken up. Meanwhile, there have been other causes that legislators in Springfield have been taking up. Joining us to talk through what happened and what didn't happen are two Illinois political reporters. Amanda Vinicky covers state government for Chicago Tonight, the news program on PBS station WTTW. Amanda, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thanks so much for being with us.
You know, I love being on with you, buddy.
For those who may not know, Amanda and I used to work together in the State House Bureau of Illinois Public Radio, which is now a seat very well occupied by Alex Degman, who covers state government for public radio stations across Illinois. Alex, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, thanks. And that actually is true. We all have held my job at one point, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
It's a good job.
Right.
It's awesome.
It is a great job. It is a great job. All right. So one of the bigger elephants in the room for veto session, and I use that phrase advisedly, has been these private school scholarship program. It's set to sunset at the end of this year. Alex, there have been a number of proposals making the rounds. Have there been any signs of compromise or progress on that?
Yes. I would say there's been some progress and there's been a little bit of compromise, but whether we're actually going to see any movement on that still remains to be seen. So first, a little bit of background on what Invest in Kids is. It's an income tax credit program that lets people donate to approved scholarship granting organizations that they then turn around and award scholarships to private schools and ideally to students who couldn't otherwise afford it. Opponents of the program call this essentially tax subsidization of private education when that money really should be going to public schools. And the governor, he's gone back and forth on this over the years. He initially said during his first campaign that this isn't a good idea, back a couple of weeks ago when he said that he would be in favor of an extension if lawmakers give him one. So that's what this is. The compromise that's been floating around for the better part of a week is a new bill that keeps the program intact for another few years, but it cuts the total amount of awards from $75 million to $50 million. And there are also changes to the amount of income tax credit you get after the first $5,000 to the SGO, the Scholarship Granting Organization. And as far as whether this moves forward, we've already heard from folks like the Illinois Freedom Caucus. That's a group of House Republicans that primarily represent Southeastern Illinois. They basically say that unless they see a proposal that makes the program permanent and keeps it pretty much as is, that this is a non-starter.
All right. So that is what's happening with that legislation. Amanda Vinicky, can you talk just briefly? I mean, it seemed like the governor might have been willing to come a little bit on board with this program. Can you talk about the divide on the Democratic side?
Yeah, I think the governor is certainly not promoting this program. He's a bit between a rock and a hard place, I think, given that he was questioned initially about this because his own children attended private school. So that's where this gets, I think, kind of tricky. You had that as well with the leader of the Chicago Teachers Union. The union is vociferously against this program. I mean, unions are really leading the charge against any sort of continuation of Invest in Kids. But lo and behold, her own child also attends a private school. And so that's what backers of this say, is that everybody should have that option and it shouldn't just be to those who can afford it. That, I think, gets to the political trick box that this legislation has legislators in. And that's because, especially Democrats, because they are aligned with labor. This is something that the Illinois Education Association, the Illinois Federation of Teachers, the two major teachers unions, are both highly critical of. They came out charging hard against Governor Pritzker, who, of course, is otherwise pretty darn well aligned with them. So they are very, very against this. And they say it's yes, because money that would otherwise be going to public schools, it's not even to say that this is money that would go to public schools, nor would it make up the deficit that public schools are in, but it's sort of a moral reasoning for teachers' unions. Then you have, however, Democrats who also want to believe in a boost for the low-income families that are in their districts. You have a lot of legislators who represent some of Chicago's more impoverished or disinvested neighborhoods where they don't have families that want to go to the local school, that they are looking for another option, and this is a way to get it for them. So that's politically dicey. And then you also have Democrats who represent districts where there are particularly big religious communities, be it they represent a section of Chicago where there are a lot of Jewish residents, or a heavily Irish Catholic neighborhood. And that's, again, where this is going to be very popular. So this is certainly not something that has a strict partisan divide. And that is where, as Alex mentioned, when you get a group or a block of legislators such as, say, the ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus, who aren't going to go for it, that's going to make a difference, because this is going to be one where every vote counts, if it even gets to the floor.
Yeah, very interesting. And I should say, I went to a Catholic high school, and the alumni list got an email from the school this week urging people to contact their legislators to support this, and saying X number of current students at that school had benefited from the program. All right, let's shift gears, talk about another topic. Amanda, earlier this week, at the start of the week, we talked about a potential override of the right of first refusal legislation that the governor had vetoed. This was an energy-related bill. It would give downstate utilities like Ameren the first option to build long-distance power line projects before any bidding could happen. Now the news this week is that supporters of the idea say they're not going to try to override the governor. What's the reasoning there?
Well, I think the reasoning is really writing on the wall that they weren't going to have success. And so you have a better shot at another bite at the power lines, if you will, down the road, if you don't have any sort of failure that has legislators sick themselves on the record, potentially on another politically dicey issue a little bit. And you can just kind of have this fight another day. This is another one where you see the strength of labor in Illinois and how that really has Democrats wanting to align themselves with powerful unions, in this case, IBEW, that back this. And yet it comes at a difficult time, because while this is just involving the downstate utility Ameren, the notion is that at some point that's going to be ComEd as well, and ComEd not particularly popular in politics, or at least openly so, because of all the corruption scandals, including one that saw its former top executives going to be sentenced to prison for their role in trying to influence former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. So whenever you have the General Assembly looking like it's doing a favor to an energy utility, that's not something that gains a lot of favor, and that consumer advocates say could lead to not only just Ameren, this being sort of an unfair boost of one company over the competition, but that competition would lead to lower results and therefore lower prices, that is, and be better for consumers. That's something that Ameren is pushing back against, and they have seen success in this sort of right of first refusal legislation in other states. They're looking to do the same in Illinois.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are recapping the first scheduled week of the veto session in the Illinois General Assembly, talking about what got done, what didn't get done, and what's on the radar when lawmakers come back in a week and a half for the second scheduled week of veto session. And maybe I should just say, we call it veto session. The idea is that if the governor vetoes a ton of legislation, this is an opportunity for lawmakers to come back and override him if they should choose to do so. But it's also really become much more than that, and it's an opportunity for lawmakers to get a second bite at the apple. Maybe if something didn't happen in the spring or something new has come up, they can tackle some new topics. And we are talking about all this with Illinois Public Radio state government reporter Alex Degman and WTTW state government correspondent Amanda Vinicky. And Alex, one thing we haven't talked as much on the program about is a proposal to allow legislative staffers to unionize. Some legislation related to that passed through the House this week, and it was actually the only major action in the House this week. But this unionization proposal, this has been bubbling up in Springfield for a while now. Can you just briefly take us through the history of this?
Sure. So voters in Illinois approved in the November election the Workers' Rights Amendment, and that basically gave all employees in Illinois the right to collectively bargain, the right to unionize. And there were some folks in Speaker Welch's office that saw that and a light went on, and they're like, oh, okay, well, this is something that we've been wanting to do for a while, so let's see if we can get this going. So the route that they took initially, because legislative employees are currently carved out of state labor laws, they asked for voluntary recognition from the Speaker's office. And after some back and forth over a number of months, that did not happen for multiple reasons. But essentially, after, you know, almost a year of back and forth, this measure popped up. This measure was filed earlier this month by Speaker Welch, and it would basically create a specific state office that would handle these negotiations for legislative employees. And while the people who would be in the union, the Illinois Legislative Staff Association, said that they are pretty pleased that this dropped, that they're pretty pleased that this is moving the way that it is, there are a number of changes that they would like to see. And not surprisingly, one of the things that we saw when it passed out of committee was an amendment pretty quickly. It included a few changes, but there are still some sticking points in the legislation as amended that I'm not sure is going to be addressed. So the strike provisions, let's talk about that first. The original bill said that people who wanted to take a labor action needed to give management 30 days notice, which doesn't really conform with current state labor law. So that was changed. That was taken down to 5 days notice that management needs. But the rules still say that they can't strike during months where a legislative day is scheduled. So for those of you keeping track, that's during a regular year where everything goes smoothly and everything the way it's supposed to go, 7 months. That's 7 months out of the year where they can't strike. And we know that there are sometimes continuous sessions, there are special sessions. So the union organizers are saying, well, that kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it? But the speaker's pretty adamant that striking is not going to impact the operations of the state. It's not going to shut down because of a strike. So they're also worried about how district staffers are going to be classified and things like that. So as I talk to the union organizers throughout this process, they just continue to tell me that the negotiations are ongoing, basically. They're pleased with how things have gone so far. And they're going to try to see if they can work with people in the Senate to see if they can amend it a little bit further.
Amanda, I don't know how much you've spoken with rank and file lawmakers about this, not the staffers, but and I know you know a bunch of staffers, too, but the lawmakers themselves. Philosophically, I mean, this would be a major change in the power dynamics. We all know the General Assembly runs on staffers. They do a lot of the sort of detail grunt work to make that place operate. How are people reacting to this?
You know, Brian, I think that this is another one. We've been talking about a lot of issues that might be difficult for lawmakers to vote on. And again, particularly, I think Democrats. And that's because you had that party so behind this amendment to the state constitution and frequently preaching about the strength of labor unions, the reason for them, that the Democratic Party believes wholly in the ability of unions to lift up families, to be on a high for protections, for higher wages. And so then it seems, you know, hypocritical. And this is something that I've asked legislators about. How can you push back against this effort at all when you want to secure labor in every other way? And you push back against, you know, businesses when they testify and say, hey, we can't do this, we can't afford it. And that is one of the concerns that you heard debated on the House floor. Most of the opposition that you heard during the debate, however, came from Republicans who said they just weren't sure how this is going to work. I have talked, however, to legislators not on the floor who say they aren't happy with this. There, as Alex noted, there have been some changes from the original proposal, and that's something that has Democrats breathing a little bit easier. And those are exemptions to those who are in the chief of staff or the number two position, whatever it may be titled, in district offices, because legislators are really thinking, how practically is this going to work? What's it going to mean for me? What if I have a constituent call, an activity on a weekend that I typically rely on staff for. One of the issues, as Alex originally reported when he sort of broke the story, is just that it's not just Brian that the General Assembly really and the legislators themselves count on staff. It's also that they count on them to be there 2 o'clock in the morning when they are having to draft or analyze or make changes to a piece of legislation in order for the legislature to meet a deadline, get it done in a certain amount of time. There's a lot of reliance on staff who are classically, we have to work very long hours at the State House and for relatively low pay. So again, this is something that I think you would have many members of the General Assembly not stand for were it any other industry. And that's where there is, I think, strength in this happening. You've seen it happen in other states, but not a sure bet in Illinois because it would likely be such a change to just the general dynamic at the Capitol.
Yeah, very much undergraduate work habits where they are there late, late into the night for much of May and other crunch times of year. All right, just about a minute left. Alex, what are you going to be watching for in the second scheduled week of the veto session?
Well, I think I'm going to be watching to see if the override of the nuclear moratorium comes up, because either the override of the nuclear moratorium that Sue Rezin, the sponsoring senator, promised earlier, or a new bill that was filed a little while ago that would essentially negate the need for the override because it takes some of the governor's concerns about advanced nuclear reactors into account. And I haven't really heard on the ground whether that is definitely going to come up in the second week, but that's something that I'll definitely be watching for.
All right. We're going to probably leave it there. Alex Degman covers Illinois state government and politics for public radio stations across the state. Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent with Chicago Tonight for WTTW. Alex and Amanda, thank you so much for being with us. And before we go, Amanda, I just want to say you haven't been on with us for quite a while, and it is because you are a new mother. So congratulations to you and Mike on the arrival of Alice. Thank you so much for being with us today. So, all right. That is going to be it. We are going to.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Amanda. All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to be talking with members of Lou Berger. In fact, we will be talking with Lou and Berger themselves. This is the 21st show. More to come. Stay with us.